Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now going to cover Leviticus chapter 11, verses 1 through 47, concerning clean and unclean animals. Our context is this. In our last chapter, we observed the death of Nadab and Abihu, Aaron's two oldest sons, who were killed by God because they offered strange fire. So now we begin in chapter 11, verses 1 through 3. The Lord spoke again to Moses and to Aaron, saying to them, "Speak to the sons of Israel, saying, these are the creatures which you may eat from all the animals that are on the earth. Whatever divides a hoof, thus making split hoofs, and chews the cud among the animals that you may eat." Now, it's going to be a lot of animals in this chapter. We've got to get some order amidst all the chaos. We've got to get some generalities amidst all the particulars. So I'm going to give you an introduction concerning the possible rationales for the clean and unclean distinction concerning animals. Before we get into the details, first of all, and this is used often, the reason God pronounced some animals clean and unclean, say these folks, is for reasons of hygiene. For example, gonorrhea and leprosy victims were excluded from the camp. You're not supposed to eat dead carcasses. Actually, gonorrhea and leprosy doesn't have anything to do with animals, but the idea is cleanliness is all through the law. Not eating dead carcasses, that's not whether an animal's clean or unclean exactly. It's whether it's dead or alive. But the idea is that a lot of, for example, not eating pigs would make you safer because eating pigs is dangerous. That's what most people say. You hear that a lot. The NIV Study Bible says this is difficult to substantiate, and I will point out to you in just a minute that, yes, it's very difficult to substantiate. Gill, however, John Gill, says that health is one reason for the law. And Creation Wiki doesn't have any difficulty in substantiating hygiene as one of the fundamental purposes of the clean-unclean animal distinction. Let me read from Creation Wiki. Quote, "The most readily evident feature that distinguishes clean from unclean animals is their diet. The clean animals are all obligate herbivores, eating only plants, whereas the unclean animals are either carnivores or scavengers. The reasons for not allowing the consumption of the latter was only realized following the development of modern scientific investigation. Carnivores and scavengers frequently carry pathogens such as parasites, which are not found in herbivores. Some scavengers also accumulate toxins to levels that are dangerous to humans. Many contend that the biblical definition of clean and unclean is an example of the scientific foreknowledge that is found in the Bible." Well, in my humble opinion, my humble unscientific opinion, I don't see any problem with saying that some of the laws would make you healthier. For example, seafood. Seafood's hard to digest. However, there are reasons against saying that the laws were mainly aimed at the hygiene of the Israelites. First of all, some unclean animals had no association with any disease. For example, a camel. There's no disease. You can eat a camel. There's no disease if you eat a camel. How about wild boars? That's unclean by the law, but you can eat a wild boar because it doesn't have trichinosis. And besides, proper cooking keeps trichinosis from spreading to humans anyway. You just got to cook the pork well. Pork was a staple, actually, of Israel's neighbors, so people did know how to eat pork safely, even back in ancient times. You often hear commentators say that, well, pork was prohibited back then in the old days, in the times of Israel, because no refrigeration is available, but we have refrigeration now, so that's the reason why the pork was unclean, was for reasons of health. Well, the short answer to that is Jesus declared everybody in his time in the New Testament era free from the law. So Jesus' contemporary could eat pork. Did they have refrigerators? Why would Jesus be turning loose people to eat something that's dangerous? So the argument that the law has to do with health is weakened very much by what I just said. Also, some animals that were clean and included in the animals that the Israelites could eat, they were health hazards. For example, clean cud chewers are a host for a number of parasitic animals. Also, many harmful things could have been included in the list of unclean things to eat, but weren't. For example, poisonous plants. How about poisonous animals? Well, I don't know. A lot of the animals that were in the law, I guess the creepy crawly things that might be poisonous were included, but some things weren't. Poisonous plants. That's a weak argument, really. Here's another argument saying that hygiene was not the reason for the distinction between clean and unclean foods. Jesus abolished the distinction. He wouldn't have done that if unclean foods would be dangerous to your health. He would have said, keep on following the law. We don't want you to get sick. I've already mentioned that. Here's a quote from a website, www.gci.org. Unfortunately, I forgot the name of that website. Here's what they say, quote, "Some people say that the rules were given for health reasons, but there is no biblical evidence for that, and scientific studies have not proven it. There is no evidence, for example, that beef is better for our health than camel meat, or that fish-eating ducks are better than fish-eating herons." Fish-eating ducks are clean under the law, and herons are not. "The Old Testament does not tell us why it permits grasshoppers, but not ants, or why it permits honey, but not honeybees. The claim about health is not a biblical claim, and it cannot be taught as doctrine." Well, that would be a good theological debate sometime, which I am not interested in getting into because I'm not under the Old Testament law, and so it doesn't matter except as an academic matter to me. But I don't think we can really say that hygiene is the reason why God made some animals clean and some unclean. So let's look at another possibility. Maybe he did so that the Israelites would avoid association with naturally disgusting animals. For example, snakes, which might go back to the curse in the garden. Slimy animals, creepy animals, rats, dogs. I remember dogs back then were wild junkyard dogs, not pets. So all these nasty animals would be naturally disgusting to the Israelites. So God wants to keep them separate from that. Because if you either sacrifice or eat such animals, it's hard to associate holiness with those animals. Well, but the problem with that argument is, one problem, is there are lots of unclean animals that were listed that aren't disgusting. For example, a rabbit. A rabbit is unclean. What's disgusting about a cute little bunny rabbit? You could say it looks like a rat because it's a rodent. Well, most people think rabbits are cute. They're not disgusting. And I'll tell you another problem with this argument is that disgusting has a lot to do with either one's personality or one's culture. For example, disgusting? I know people, I lived in South China for years, and I guarantee you, they ate things that I consider disgusting and they thought was delicious. Scorpions with their tails cooked up. That's a delicacy in Hong Kong. I know a guy, a Chinese man whose name was Philip Law, I still remember it, who calmly told me that eating rats was good. He'd eaten rats. And I said, well, what about the disease? He said, oh, no, you cook it well. It tastes just like chicken. I saw a restaurant in Shenzhen, and on the restaurant, sitting right there, in Chinese characters, it says dog meat. They were advertising their wares, what they were selling. They were selling dog meat. To me, that's disgusting. Not to Southern Chinese. Now, Northern Chinese people think this is disgusting, too. My point is, it's cultural. What's disgusting is cultural, so I don't think possibility number two is going to explain the clean unclean distinction. All right, so let's go to possibility number three. God made some animals clean and some unclean to avoid association with pagan religious practices. For example, a pig was used to sacrifice to demons and underworld deities among the Hittites, the Egyptians, and the Mesopotamians. Are we onto something here? Well, I don't think so, because bulls were often used in pagan sacrifices, and bulls were perfectly clean under the Levitical law. In fact, bulls were sacrificed a lot of times. For example, the sin offering for the high priest. So, option number three to explain the clean and unclean distinction is not going to fly, in my humble opinion. Now, let's go to option number four, to separate the Israelites from the Gentiles. Gentiles were considered unclean. Now, there were three categories in the clean, unclean system. There you got animals, which we're talking about now. You got people, and you got places. Well, when we're talking about animals, you had clean sacrificial animals. You had clean non-sacrificial animals that could be eaten like a deer. A clean sacrificial animal would be like a bull, a ram, or a goat. Clean non-sacrificial animal would be like a deer. Category number three would be unclean animals not to be eaten nor to be sacrificed, like a pig. And the fourth category is an unclean animal that is a, quote, abomination. Home and Christian Study Bible has detestable. That's a really unclean animal. And of course, you had clean and unclean people. Priests were holy. Ordinary Israelites were clean. Non-Israelites were unclean. And some Israelites were an abomination. Really unclean. And how about clean and unclean places? The tabernacle is holy. The land is clean. The land of Israel is clean. And the rest of the world is unclean. So you see this distinction in almost every aspect of the Israelites' life. Between clean and very clean. Very clean would be holy. Clean would be just ordinarily clean. And unclean is bad, but very unclean, detestable. So you see that distinction. Well, the animals help, the clean and unclean animal distinction helps maintain that distinction. so that Israelites would be called a peculiar people distinct from the Gentiles around them. And I think there's your answer right there, option number four. The food laws naturally separated the Jews from the Gentile world. The food laws were a practical means of maintaining Israel as a holy people. As Jameson Fawcett Brown says, the food laws, the clean and unclean animal distinction, made Jews so peculiar they couldn't intermingle with their pagan neighbors. That makes a lot of sense. Here's a scripture to back that up, Leviticus 20, verses 25 and 26. You are therefore to make a distinction between the clean animal and the unclean, and between the unclean bird and the clean. And you shall not make yourselves detestable by animal or by bird or by anything that creeps on the ground, which I have separated for you as unclean. Thus you are to be holy to me, for I the Lord am holy, and I have set you apart from the peoples to be mine, the peoples of the Gentiles. So you're to be holy, separate from the world, separate from the Gentiles, consecrated unto God. And how do we sow that? Well, verse 25 says, distinction between the clean animal and the unclean. I think that's pretty clear. There are other verses that state the same distinction. For example, Leviticus 11, 44 and 45, which I won't read. And then also Deuteronomy 14, there's more clean and unclean distinction. A brother named Denver Chetty on the internet says that these verses stress the fact that Israel were God's people. It was okay for foreigners to eat unclean foods, but not Israel. So why then was it okay for them, but not for Israel? Because Israel were God's people. They were to be different. It had to be clear to anyone by observing his people that their God was holy. The reason for this apparent change of God's mind was to make a distinction between Israel and the other nations. I may have done differently if I were God, but fortunately for the reader, I am not. God just decided, I want you to be different, and this is how. So basically, the idea there from that quotation is that there's not really a scientific or logical reason why some animals are clean and some are unclean, but the reason is it was just to make a distinction between the Jews and the Gentiles who ate food, other foods. I really think that there's your answer right there. That's option number four, to explain the clean and unclean distinction. Here's option number five, to teach the holiness of God and the guilt of man. Now, that's probably the most important reason for the Levitical laws in general. At the end of the food laws, at the end of our chapter in this audio, we will read Leviticus 11, verses 44 and 45. For I am the Lord your God. Consecrate yourselves, therefore, and be holy, for I am holy. And you shall not make yourselves unclean with any of the unswarming things that swarm on the earth. For I am the Lord who brought you up from the land of Egypt to be your God. Thus you shall be holy, for I am holy. And so, by teaching distinctions between what you can and what you cannot eat, that teaches, that reinforces the idea that we are distinct from the world and separated unto God, and that God is distinct from the world. Basically, option number five is very similar to option number four. Option number four says we want to separate the Israelites from the Gentiles, and option number five says we want to separate the Israelites from the world in general and consecrate them to God. So really, that's the same option. So we're going to go with that. That's the reason for the clean, unclean animal distinction in the Levitical laws, is to separate God's people from the world and unto himself. Now in verse 1, we can begin now. Verse 1 says, the Lord spoke again to Moses and to Aaron. At the first part of Leviticus, God was speaking to Moses as God set up the sacrificial regimen. And then in our last chapter, I think it was, maybe the chapter before that, he started speaking to Aaron because Aaron was in charge of all the sacrifices as they began to do sacrifices for the people. Now God's speaking to both of them. Moses is the political leader. Aaron is the religious leader. And he announces the food laws. These are the creatures you can eat, and these are the creatures that you cannot eat. Now, 10 particular animals that you could eat are listed as clean in Deuteronomy. Just to give some background. Deuteronomy 14 is not quite as precise as the law is in Leviticus 15. But Deuteronomy 14, verses 4 through 5 said, these are the animals which you may eat. The ox, the sheep, the goat. Well, those were the sacrificial animals. An ox is basically a bull. It's a castrated bull. I don't know why the translations say ox. I really wish they'd say bull, but they don't. The sheep, the goat. So you can eat steak, you can eat lamb, and you can eat goat. The deer, you can eat venison. The gazelle and roebuck are kinds of deer. The wild goat is just like, I don't know what the difference between a goat and a wild goat is. I guess that's a mountain goat. The ibex. Now, an ibex is an interesting creature. I've actually seen one. I was at Raymond, I guess is how you say it, R-A-M-O-N, which is a big crater in the Negev in southern Israel. And I was sitting on the side of the road for some reason. I don't remember why. Maybe the tour guide let us out so we could take pictures of this big crater, which looks like Mars, and which is something, if you're ever in the south of Israel, go see Ramon. Look it up on Wikipedia and go there. It's awesome. Looks just like Mars. But these little goat-like animals came up. They're kind of miniature goats. The babies don't have horns. The adults have these huge horns. And they were very friendly, and they didn't act like they were scared of tourists. They came right up next to me, and I never had seen one before. I said, well, what are you, bud? What kind of an animal are you? And I found out later it was an ibex. So they're still around. The antelope, of course, is kind of a deer, and a mountain sheep is another kind of sheep. So it gives you an idea what the clean animals are. And it's interesting to me that the Levitically clean animals are very similar to the animals that we eat. I say we, I mean we in the West, let's put it that way. I know some people won't eat a deer because they think it's Bambi, which is absurd. And a lot of times we don't eat goat meat. But people do eat goat meat. It's not considered horrible. Now, this distinction between clean and unclean animals, that distinction is old as the time of Noah, as the NIV Study Bible points out. We read in Genesis 7:2 at the time of Noah, quote, "You shall take with you of every clean animal by sevens, a male and his female, seven pairs of clean animals, and of the animal that are not clean, two pairs of unclean animals." So there's the distinction. According to the NIV Study Bible, that distinction concerned animals used in sacrifice. In other words, some animals are clean for sacrifice, some are not clean for sacrifice. And of course, sacrifice, if the Levitical law codified the practice that went on earlier, that would be animals from the herd, bulls, cows, animals from the flock. That would be sheep, ewes, and rams. Ewes are female, rams are male. And animals, and another herd animal, another flock animal would be a goat, a male goat or a she-goat. But this distinction between clean and unclean at the time of Noah did not concern animals used to eat. Why do we know that? Because in Genesis 9:3 it says this, "Every moving thing that is alive shall be food for you. I give all to you as I gave the green plant." Every moving thing. Well, that would include pigs. That would include shrimp. So some people say that the Levitical prohibitions against eating unclean animals were to protect the sacrifices. In other words, the idea is you have to eat clean animals, and some of those clean animals are going to be sacrificed. So there's a difference between what can be sacrificed and not sacrificed. That would make people realize that only certain sacrifices were considered holy. And of course, if this is true, that the reason for the law, food laws, was to keep the sacrifices holy, and since Jesus came to do away with the need for sacrifices for people's sins, therefore the dietary laws are gone because we don't need animal sacrifices anymore. And therefore we don't need dietary laws anymore because there's no point in trying to separate the clean and unclean for the purposes of sacrifice. Now, of course, there's a huge theological debate over this, a debate which I do not intend to get involved in. Here's a good website. Should Christians eat pork? Listen, folks, I eat sausage just about every day. I like patty sausage. I like link sausage. And how about fried bacon? Oh my gosh. Mixed in grits with eggs, all chopped up, mixed in with country fried ham, which is pork. How about pork chops? Oh my gosh. Pig is the best food you'll ever eat. You couldn't live in China without pigs. China has more pigs than any other country in the world. I saw on BBC one time, and I believe it. I never saw so many pigs over there. Pork, they eat pork. And if you're going to eat Chinese food, you're going to have to eat pigs. Otherwise, you're going to starve to death. So I believe that we are free from the Old Testament law. We're not under it. I can go to the mat on that one. I'll stand on the hill and defend that proposition to the death. I don't even want to talk about it. I don't even want to debate that. It's so obvious that we're free from the Old Testament law. So, although some Christians will debate whether the dietary laws are here or gone, I'm not going to debate it because I know beyond a shadow of a doubt, to a reasonable certitude, beyond cavil or equivocation, the dietary laws are kaputsky. They're gone. Now, verse 3 mentions split hooves and cuds. Now, here's the deal. If you want an animal that's clean, you got to jump two hurdles. First hurdle, the animal has to have a split hoof. Second hurdle, the animal has to chew the cud. If you miss any one of those hurdles, it's unclean and you can't eat it. Also, a split hoof means split all the way, not divided in the sense that it starts to be split. We'll see that distinction a little bit later. It has to be split all the way. Now, going back to these commentators who love to think that the law, the purpose of the law is hygiene, which I don't hold to, but I will mention this because I think it's kind of funny. This is a comment from Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown. Why are split-hooved animals cleaner? Because the split hooves allow noxious substances to be discharged between the toes. Now remember, this is written in the 1800s. People writing science in the 22nd century are going to laugh at us in the 21st century. When we write scientific things, especially like about COVID-19, they're going to laugh at us, so I want to try to be gentle here. Here's what Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown says, quote, in the case of animals with parted hooves, split hooves, when feeding in unfavorable situations, a prodigious amount of fetid matter is discharged and passes off between the toes, while animals with undivided hoofs feeding on the same ground become severely affected in the legs from the poisonous plants among the pasture. Well, I'm not a veterinarian. I'm not an animal person, an animal doctor, or an animal scientist, a zoologist. So I don't know, but that sounds kind of funny to me. I don't believe that that's why they weren't supposed to eat animals with split hooves. I could be wrong. Maybe this is true, even though it's a little bit outdated. How about animals that chew the cud? Well, the food of cud-chewing animals is said to be healthier. Here's another quote from Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown. Ruminating animals, by the peculiar structure of their stomachs, digest their food more fully than others. It is found that in the act of chewing the cud, a large portion of the poisonous properties of noxious plants eaten by them passes off by the salivary glands. The power of secreting the poisonous effects of vegetables is said to be particularly remarkable in cows and goats, whose mouths are often sore and sometimes bleed in consequence. Their flesh is therefore in a better state for food, as it contains more of the nutritious juices, is more easily digested in the human stomach, and is consequently more easily assimilated. Animals which do not chew the food convert their food less perfectly. Their flesh is therefore unwholesome. And I think what Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown is saying here is that when food is eaten by the cow, anything that's not healthy is eaten up by the saliva, the poisonous effects of vegetables, whatever that is. And so the animal in chewing the cud is killing the poison in the vegetables as it chews the cud. They chew the cud and pay the price because the mouth gets sore from the poison in the vegetables they're eating. Well, again, I don't know. I just think that's interesting. But again, I don't think it's the health reasons why you're not supposed to eat split hooves and cuds. It's just arbitrary on the part of God to keep them different, keep the Jews different from the surrounding nations. We're going out of Leviticus 11, 4 through 8. Nevertheless, you are not to eat of these among those which chew the cud or among those which divide the hoof. The camel, for though it chews cud, it does not divide the hoof. Remember, you got to jump over both hurdles. You got to chew the cud and have a split hoof if you're going to be able to eat it. It is unclean to you, this camel. Likewise, the shafan. The NIV has the coney. I have no idea what that is. The NIV note says it might be a hyrax or a rock badger. Well, that's nice. I don't know what those are either. For though it chews the cud, it does not divide the hoof. It is unclean to you. The rabbit also, for though it chews cud, it does not divide the hoof, it is unclean to you. And the pig, though it divides the hoof, thus making a split hoof, it does not chew cud, it is unclean to you. You shall not eat of their flesh, nor touch their carcasses, they are unclean to you. All right, this shafan, or however you say it, the coney, the hyrax, the rock badger, Adam Clark says it resembles a rabbit. In verse 8, it says that none of these animals are to be touched. It means in the sense of touching them in order to kill them for food. Of course, it was okay for Jews to ride on camels or to use pig fat to make medicine. That wouldn't make them unclean. It means to kill them in order to make food out of it. Now, the pig, of course, is notorious for being unclean. We all know about pigs. And here's what Adam Clark says about a pig. Quote, one of the most gluttonous, libidinous, and filthy quadrupeds in the universe. Lord have mercy. I think this guy has got a problem. Somehow a pig did something to him in his childhood that has warped his attitude. A libidinous pig? Have you ever seen a horny pig before? Gluttonous, yes. They love to snort around and eat anything in sight. But libidinous? Filthy? Oh, yes. They're dirty. In the universe? I don't know. Has he looked all over the universe to find an animal dirtier than a pig? Well, you see, the poor pig. Think about that the next time you're chomping down on some link sausage mixed with grits. Now, one little problem here, verse 6, it says, the rabbit, though it chews the cud, it does not divide the hoof, chews the cud. Rabbits chew the cud? Actually, they don't chew the cud, as the NIV Study Bible points out. And, of course, all the God-hating liberals, the scripture-hating liberals, see there, the Bible's got errors in it. I've actually seen this at some point. I forgot where some skeptic was saying, see there, the Bible's got errors in it. Well, the NIV Study Bible says the way you handle that is that the constant chewing movement of a rabbit caused the rabbit to be popularly classified with cud chewers. If you look at a rabbit, that's what they do. Their little snouts are twitching all the time. They look like they're chewing all the time, although they're not actually chewing food. We go now to Leviticus 11, verses 9 through 12. These you may eat, whatever is in the water, all that have fins and scales, those in the water, in the seas or in the rivers you may eat. But whatever is in the seas and in the rivers that does not have fins and scales among all the teeming life of the water and among all the living creatures that are in the water, they are detestable things to you, and they shall be abhorrent to you. You may not eat of their flesh, and their carcasses you shall detest. Whatever in the water does not have fins and scales is abhorrent to you. Well, fins and scales goes together, because whatever has fins has scales, and of course that sounds like fish. Those things that are in the water that do not have fins and scales are things like eels and frogs and shellfish. Well, we eat shellfish, clams, scallops. Eels and frogs are eaten in China all the time. We don't eat them here so much. But they weren't clean, so the Jews weren't supposed to eat them. Now, why should they not have been eaten? Adam Clark suggests, again, for health reasons. They're hard to digest. Their bodies were covered with a thick, glutinous matter and were very difficult to digest. Well, I've heard it said that seafood is difficult to digest. I'm from South Carolina, and everybody down here worships. I don't mean they like. I mean they worship seafood, and I don't eat it. Not because it's difficult to digest. I just don't like it. I don't know why. But I know lots of people with shrimp allergy. Boy, they just smell of shrimp, and their throat closes up, and their skin breaks out in hives. Seafood is hard to digest. Seafood is not fish. Fish is easy to digest, but if they don't have seafood that doesn't have fins and scales, it's hard to digest. This thing about health being a rationale for the law, it is true that if you follow the law, you're probably going to be healthier in general. It's just that all animals don't fit. There's some perfectly healthy animals that are excluded. Leviticus 11, verses 13 through 19, these, moreover, you shall detest among the birds. You see, we're going from animals on the land with hooves and legs. We started in that in verses 4 through 8. Then we went to the rivers and the seas, the sea animals. Now we're going to the air animals, the birds. These, moreover, you shall detest among the birds. They are abhorrent, not to be eaten. The eagle, can you imagine eating an American eagle? And the vulture, oh, a vulture and an eagle are actually the same family. It's just the eagle is a pretty vulture and a vulture is an ugly eagle. The Greek and the Chinese have the same word for both animals. Apparently the Hebrews got different words. But we have these vultures that are called turkey buzzards in South Carolina, and they love to eat roadkill. You're driving down the road. I remember driving to church one morning, and this tremendous turkey buzzard comes flying out from the side of the road, flying right in front of my windshield. I could see the whites of his eyes. And, of course, I had to slam on the brakes, and I thought I was going to have a wreck. I don't like those things, and I certainly wouldn't eat one, because I see him chomping on dead deer, dead possums. The buzzard, the kite, those are scavenger-type birds, the falcon, and its kind. Kind means the related birds to a falcon. Every raven and its kind, and the ostrich, and the owl, and the seagull, and the hawk and its kind, and the little owl, and the cormorant. A cormorant is a bird that has a long neck, and they swallow things whole and slide and go down that neck. In China, they would put rings around the cormorant's neck. I forgot why they did that. And the great owl, and the white owl, and the pelican, and the carrion vulture, and the stork, the heron and its kinds, and the hoopoe, or the hoopoe, I don't know how to pronounce that, and the bat. Now, I'm not going to go over all those animals, I'll tell you why. Of all the animals in Leviticus, the translators are only certain of about 40% of them. 40%! This is according to Bob Deffenbaugh, who for Dallas Seminary's Bible.org page has got a ton of articles on Leviticus, and so I take his word for it. 40% of all the animals, the translators know which animals they are. So I'm not going to worry about which birds are being referred to. You can see that most of them are scavenger types. The NIV note has here, the precise identification of some of the birds, insects, and animals in this chapter is uncertain. See there? Now, here's a perfect answer to a New Testament legalist who says we're under the dietary laws, like, for example, Seventh-day Adventist, or even an Orthodox Jew. No Orthodox Jew or Seventh-day Adventist even knows which animal is clean or unclean. So, he's in constant danger of sinning without knowing it. He might eat a bird that he thinks is clean, but it's unclean because he doesn't know the translation of the birds. So, there's no way that a Seventh-day Adventist can reasonably be expected to keep the law. I'd love to try to use that on it. I'm sure they've got an answer for it. I haven't heard it yet because I don't get involved in these silly debates about whether you can eat what in the New Testament. But I would like to present that to a Seventh-day Adventist just to see what they say. We go now to Leviticus 11, verses 20 through 23. All the winged insects. Now we've gone from birds in the sky. Now we're going to creepy, crawly things. Insects. Well, let's just say insects. We're going to insects. Verse 20, Leviticus 11. All the winged insects that walk on all fours are detestable to you. Verse 21 through 23, yet these you may eat among all the winged insects which walk on all fours, those which have above their feet jointed legs with which to jump on the earth. That, of course, would be grasshoppers and locust. Verse 22, these of them you may eat, the locust in its kinds, and the devastating locust in its kinds, and the cricket in its kinds, and the grasshopper in its kinds. But all other winged insects which are four-footed are detestable to you. Now, the first thing that you're going to notice is you're going to say, wait a minute, I was taught in school that insects have six legs, and now that you're talking about, Leviticus is talking about winged insects which have four legs. They walk on all fours, verse 20, verse 23, they are four-footed. And, of course, the liberals will say, see there? The people that wrote Leviticus were stupid. They didn't even know that an insect had six legs. They couldn't pick up an insect and count and get six. Well, first of all, the people in Leviticus weren't stupid. Anybody could count the legs on an insect. So why did they say the insect had four legs? Well, here's to me, well, there's a couple of possible solutions. The best one, in my opinion, is to just say that ancient people didn't count the two large hind legs that were used as jumping as ordinary legs. When you look at one of those animals, and that those two hind legs are right striking. They look different than an ordinary leg, so they didn't count those two. The other four normal-looking legs were counted as legs, and that solves the problem easily. Gill and Clark suggest another way to handle the four-legged insects is to say that that expression perhaps should not be taken literally, that it means to walk regularly or progressively as opposed to hopping. That's similar to the idea that the two hind legs weren't ordinary legs. For example, we say that a dog walks on all fours as opposed to standing up on his hind legs. He walks on all fours. He walks, in other words, as opposed to hopping. An example of an insect that does that without literally having four legs is a millipede. How many legs does a millipede have? 1,000? Well, that's probably an exaggeration. It's got a lot. I've seen them. Centipedes, they don't have as many, but they got a lot of legs. They don't have four. But the thing is, they're walking on all fours. That's how we use the language. We walk on all fours. It means we're not hopping along on our back two legs if we're an animal, if we're a dog or a cat. And that makes sense, too, actually. We go now to Leviticus 11, verses 24 and 25. By these, moreover, you will be made unclean. Whoever touches their carcasses becomes unclean until evening, and whoever picks up any of their carcasses shall wash his clothes and be unclean until evening. Now, this is talking about the carcasses, the dead bodies of unclean animals, not clean. So you notice that all you have to do is touch the body. You don't have to eat the animal to be unclean. You just touch the body. Now, even though it refers to carcasses of unclean animals, what about the carcasses of clean animals? Are they included? Well, they would be unclean too, not because of the kind of animal it was, but because the animal would be associated with this. For a deer would be clean, but if it's a dead deer, you don't touch it. Not because it's a deer, but because it's dead. And death, of course, is the furthest thing from holiness you can get. And besides, Leviticus 11:39 says this, also if one of the animals dies which you have for food, now that's a clean animal, the one who touches its carcass becomes unclean until evening. So you touch a clean animal or a dead or an unclean animal that's dead, it doesn't matter. You're unclean until evening. Now we move to Leviticus 11, verses 26, 27, and 28. concerning all the animals which divide the hoof but do not make a split hoof, or which do not chew cud, they are unclean to you. Whoever touches them becomes unclean. Also, whatever walks on its paws, among all the creatures that walk on all fours, are unclean to you. Whoever touches their carcasses becomes unclean until evening, and the one who picks up their carcasses shall wash his clothes and be unclean till evening. They are unclean to you. First question, verse 26, why does it say all the animals who divide the hoof but do not make a split hoof? That's because a divided hoof is the first step towards a split hoof. The NIV translates it this way, quote, split hoof not completely divided. So divided hoof's not good enough. You got to be all the way split before it's clean. Now, what's an animal that does not have a split hoof but does chew cud? Well, that would be a camel. It's not clean. What's an example of an animal that has a divided hoof but does not chew cud? That would be a pig. It's not clean. It's got to be both. Got to have a split hoof. It's got to chew cud. Verse 27, also whatever walks on its paws. Examples of that would be apes, lions, bears, wolves, foxes, dogs, cats. They're unclean. You don't eat them. As Jameson Fawcett Brown says, prohibited animals under this description include not only the beasts which have a single hoof, as horses and asses, but those also which divide the foot into paws, as lions and tigers and so forth. We go now to Leviticus 11, verses 29 through 35. Now, these are to you the unclean among the swarming things which swarm on the earth. The mole and the mouse and the great lizard and its kinds and the gecko and the crocodile and the lizard and the sand reptile and the chameleon. These are to you the unclean among all the swarming things. Whoever touches them when they are dead becomes unclean until evening. Also, anything of which one of them may fall when they are dead becomes unclean, including any wooden article or clothing or skin or a sack, any article of which use is made. It shall be put in the water and be unclean until evening, then it becomes clean. As for any earthenware vessel into which any of them may fall, whatever is in it becomes unclean, and you shall break the vessel. Any of the food which may be eaten on which water comes shall become unclean, and any liquid which may be drunk in every vessel shall become unclean. Everything, moreover, on which part of their carcass may fall becomes unclean. An oven or a stove shall be smashed. They are unclean and shall continue as unclean to you. Verse 29, it says, these are to you the unclean among the swarming things which swarm on the earth. That's opposed to the things that fly. These are the creepy, crawly critters. Let's just take the mouse as the representative of the kind of animal we're talking about here. If that mouse, when he's dead, you touch it, he's unclean. Of course, it doesn't matter whether he's dead or clean. The animal makes you unclean until evening. Also, anything the mouse may touch, if it falls on, let's say it dies and then falls on a wooden article, clothing, skin, sack, anything, that article is unclean. Now, the article which becomes unclean has got to be doused in water, soaked in water until evening. It takes all days washing my water to become clean. If it falls into an earthenware vessel, like a clay pot or something, it's unclean, and you got to break the vessel. Clay pots, of course, are cheap, and they were porous. And since they were porous, they would absorb uncleanness. But they're easy to break, cheap to break, so they are broken and become unclean. Anything that the dead mouse falls on becomes unclean, like an oven or a stove, which is also clay probably. They'll be smashed. The NIV says any food that could be eaten but has water on it from such a pot is unclean. In other words, the mouse falls in the pot, you put the water in the pot, and you put that water on the food, now the food is unclean. If you drink water from you wouldn't want to drink water from the pot because it's unclean. In other words, all otherwise clean liquids become unclean if poured from an unclean vessel. There's nothing complicated about all this. Now, all of these uncleanliness regulations, according to Jameson Fawcett and Brown, they are extremely useful to enforce attention to uncleanness. And he's hung up on the health thing. He says that helps people pay more attention to health. Leviticus 11, verses 36 through 38. Nevertheless, a spring or cistern collecting water shall be clean, though the one who touches their carcass shall be unclean. If a part of their carcass falls on any seed for sowing which is to be sown, it is clean. Though if water is put on the seed and a part of their carcass falls on it, it is unclean to you. Now, interesting, when we talk about a spring or a cistern, if a dead mouse falls into it, you would think it would be unclean, but it's not. It's clean. Why? Well, John Gill says because there's so much water in a cistern or a spring that the little bit of defilement from the dead mouse or the dead gecko, whatever, that little bit of defilement is easily covered. I think the real reason is, though, is that the water is so valuable the Israelites would be hurt if the water was declared unclean. Although, I must say, a dead mouse in your water, do you really want to drink that? I don't know. The one who touches their carcass shall be unclean. And what that little phrase is put in there for at the end of verse 36 refers to people who are bathing in the water. That water is clean. The water comes from the cistern. The dead mouse falls into the cistern. The water is clean. You're clean if you're taking a bath in it. But if you touch the mouse itself, well, now that's a different story. Then you are unclean. Verse 37, if a part of their carcass, the dead animal, falls on any seed for sowing which is to be sown, it is clean. Now, that's interesting. Well, you would think that would be unclean. Seed for sowing, dead mouse hits it. Here's four options as to why the seed remains clean. First of all, seed is valuable for food because it was for the necessary provision for man, as Matthew Poole, the commentator, puts it. That seed needed to be planted next year, and if you can't plant it, well, then you hurt your crop. That makes sense. Here's option number two, why the seed with the dead mouse on it is still clean. That seed can grow out of its uncleanness. As Ellicott puts it, quote, the growing plant constantly derives new elements from below and fresh moisture from above, and so therefore it can cleanse itself. Option number three is why plant seed, sowing seed that's dry and is touches a dead creepy crawly thing, but is nevertheless clean. The third reason why it is still clean is that its, quote, uncleanness attached to it externally would be absorbed by the earth. That's Kyle and Delitzsch's idea. In other words, as soon as you plant the seed, the earth's going to soak up the uncleanness. Here's a similar idea from Gill and Matthew Poole. The seed would go through many changes before it became food for man. You plant the seed, it germinates, it soaks up nutrients from the soil, and it soaks up air and water from above and so forth, and then it grows into a little plant and into a big plant, and so it's not the same seed by the time you eat it, so therefore we won't say that it's unclean. All of that makes perfectly good sense, but now verse 38 tells us if water falls on that seed for sowing, and that doesn't mean unclean water, clean water even, just normal water is on the seed, and then the dead mouse falls on the seed that already has water on it, that watery seed is unclean. Why? Option number one, as John Gill says, the wet seed is more susceptible of impurity. Here's a quote from Ellicott backing Gill up, quote, the fluid softens the corn and thus enables the defilement of the carcass to penetrate into its very fibers. The wet corn, therefore, is regarded in the same light as porous clay vessels, which become saturated with defilement and must be broken. That makes sense. Option number two, why does the water make the seed for planting unclean? Option number two is because the seed now cannot be used for planting, so its value for planting is gone, as the commentator Benson says. Option number three, putting water on the seed means it would be used for food, not for planting. And of course, if it was used for food, then its rationale, the rationale for it having value as planting for the future is gone. You're just using it as ordinary food, and of course that would be unclean if ordinary food hits a dead, creepy, crawly, unclean animal. So nothing complicated there. It's minute, but it's not really difficult to interpret. We go now to verses 39 and 40, Leviticus 11. Also, if one of the animals dies which you have for food, the one who touches its carcass becomes unclean until evening. He too who eats some of its carcass shall wash his clothes and be unclean until evening, and the one who picks up its carcass shall wash his clothes and be unclean until evening. Now, an animal that dies, that means it dies on its own, keels over and has a heart attack for whatever, gets old and dies, or it's killed by another animal. You can't eat those animals. You can't touch them. Become unclean. Can't eat them. And by the way, being unclean means you can't participate in a peace offering, for example, or in a Passover, any festival. So all you have to do is touch the dead animal, you're unclean, and if you eat some of its carcass, a fortiori, I would think, you will also be unclean until evening, because that's touching it big time, it's putting it on your insides. And the one who picks up its carcass, that's the same thing as touching it, shall wash his clothes and be unclean until evening. The difference is, I suppose, in verse 39, is if you touch the dead animal, you're unclean till evening, but if you eat the dead animal or you pick up the carcass of a dead animal, you're not only unclean till evening, you have to wash your clothes also. And by the way, this eating in verse 40 is talking about eating an animal which has died on its own, either by just dying or having been killed by another animal. It's not talking about an animal that's slain by an Israelite, because if that were true, then an Israelite could never kill a sacrifice, a peace offering, a burnt offering, anything. He would be automatically unclean. He would be in the temple precincts doing that. So no, that's not what it's talking about. It's talking about an animal that dies on its own. We go now to Leviticus 11, verses 41 through 45. Now, every swarming thing that swarms on the earth is detestable not to be eaten, whatever crawls on its belly, and whatever walks on all fours, whatever has many feet, in respect to every swarming thing that swarms on the earth, you shall not eat them, for they are detestable. Do not render yourselves detestable through any of the swarming things that swarm, and you shall not make yourself unclean with them so that you become unclean. For I am the Lord your God. Consecrate yourselves, therefore, and be holy, for I am holy, and you shall not make yourselves unclean with any of the swarming things that swarm on the earth. For I am the Lord who brought you up from the land of Egypt to be your God. Thus you shall be holy, for I am holy. Now, swarming things have already been mentioned in verses 29 and 30. And let's mention them in particular, verses 29 and 30, chapter 11, Leviticus. Now these are to you the unclean among the swarming things which swarm on the earth, the mole and the mouse and the great lizard in its kinds, and the gecko and the crocodile and the lizard and the sand reptile and the chameleon, creepy crawly things, swarming things. In fact, the KJV has creeping things. They're low, they have short feet, and you can't see it until it creeps or moves along, as John Gill says. 42, whatever crawls on its belly, that would be a snake. Whatever walks on all fours, that would be any other creepy crawly insect type. Millipedes, centipedes. Now verse 43 says, do not render yourselves detestable through any of the swarming things that swarm. There's an exception to that. In verse 22, which we've already read, Leviticus 11, these of them you may eat, the locust in its kinds and the devastating locust in its kinds. Two kinds of locust there. And the cricket in its kinds, and the grasshopper in its kinds. So you can eat grasshoppers and crickets. Verse 44 says, for I am the Lord your God, consecrate yourselves therefore, and be holy, for I am holy. Holiness is the key theme of Leviticus, as the NIV Study Bible says. The word holy appears in Leviticus more than any other book in the Bible. The NIV Study Bible says that, and also that all of life had a certain ceremonial quality. And all of this goes to show, in my opinion, that the whole purpose of the dietary laws is to make the Israelites a peculiar people, separate from the world, separate from the ordinary person in the world. Now, some other scriptures in Leviticus, over and over, I am holy. I want you to be holy because I'm holy. Let's look at this to get the full impact of it. Leviticus 19:2, speak to the entire Israelite community and tell them, be holy because I, Yahweh, your God, am holy. Leviticus 27, consecrate yourselves and be holy, for I am Yahweh, your God. Leviticus 20:26, you are to be holy to me, because I, Yahweh, am holy, and I have set you apart from the nations to be mine. Set apart means to be holy, to be sanctified. Leviticus 21:8, you are to consider him holy, since he presents the food of your God. He will be holy to you, because I, that's the priest, will be holy, because I, Yahweh, who set you apart, am holy. Set you apart. Another way of saying sanctified, or which is the same thing as saying be holy. Leviticus 21:15, so that he does not corrupt his bloodline among his people, for I am Yahweh who sets him apart. Again, set apart means to make holy. Leviticus 22:9, they must keep my instruction or they will be guilty and die because they profane it. I am Yahweh who sets them apart. That means to sanctify or to make holy. Leviticus 22:16, I am Yahweh who sets them apart. Leviticus 22:32, you must not profane my holy name. I must be treated as holy among the Israelites. I am Yahweh who sets you apart. So you see, the theme of Leviticus is holiness. I brought you up from the land of Egypt. Now that was a big deal. That was a big type. The migration from the bondage in Egypt, the escape, is of course the grand type, the antitype of which is our escape from bondage to sin and our fleeing into the promised land, the rest of Christ. Eight times in Leviticus, that's mentioned. I won't read them for you. That idea of I am your God who brought you up from the land of Egypt is mentioned 60 times in 18 other books in the Old Testament, according to the NIV Study Bible. I am God who brought you out of Egypt. Leviticus 11, verses 46 and 47. This is the law regarding the animal and the bird, and every living thing that moves in the waters and everything that swarms on the earth, to make a distinction between the unclean and the clean, between the edible creature and the creature which is not to be eaten. Now these last two verses of the chapter are meant to be a summary of the whole chapter 11. And so let's summarize the categories of animals. This is from Joe Sprinkle, who has an excellent article on the internet about Leviticus. Four different categories of animals. First, you got clean animals that could be sacrificed and could be eaten. That would be like the bull, the ram, and the goat. Category number two, clean animals that you could eat but not sacrifice. That'd be like a deer. Third category, an unclean animal that couldn't be eaten and couldn't be sacrificed. That would be like a pig. Now, the fourth category is an animal which is particularly unclean, more unclean than the average unclean animal. And the Hebrew word, which I don't know, but the word is translated sometimes as cultic abomination or abomination, abhorrence. The Holden Christian Study Bible uses the word detestable, and there are several scriptures where that's used. So that's a handy paradigm, if you will, to talk about animals. Two kinds of clean animals and two kinds of unclean. Clean animals that can be eaten, clean animals that can be eaten and sacrificed. That's two categories. And then unclean animals and detestable animals. Two unclean animal categories. Ladies and gentlemen, that's all we're going to talk about, animals. Clean and unclean animals. We're getting ready now to go into chapter 12 of Leviticus. Fortunately, it's only 8 verses long. Purification of a woman after childbirth. I hope you stay tuned for that audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.